Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening and welcome to the LA Steel Show. I'm Lila.
And I'm Leo.
Tonight we have a good show for you. We have an interview with Larry Dorman from the AFSCME Union in Connecticut, American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees. And he's going to talk to us about union issues, what's happening, and why be a union member, and what have unions done for people, and what they've done for the middle class in this country. He was on our AFM show out of Lakeville, Connecticut last
AMF.
Night. AMFM show. Pardon me, folks. FM show out of Lakeville, Connecticut last night, Q103.3 FM. And we taped that, and we're going to bring that to you as soon as we read a little alternative news. So is that what your plan was for tonight, Leo?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. We also had on our show last night, which I don't know whether Leo taped or not, we had a veteran on who writes poetry, and he read some of his poetry in celebration of Memorial Day just to recognize it. He did a great job.
His name is Dale Wise, and he publishes Post Traumatic Press. Is his publishing outfit, and he's got a book.
Yeah, he was really the editor of that book. He compiled a number of poems from other veterans, and he did a nice job, I thought.
And he read about it on his own book as well, Basic Load. But I don't know if we'll have time to do that one tonight, but we'll have his interview, but we'll do the...
Ask me with Larry Dorman.
Yeah, that was important. And
we had a pretty good show, and then we had actually John Brennan on, who's our weekly guest, and he talks about chemtrails and other issues. So, but we'll bring you the Ask Me interview. In the meantime, from MedGadget.com, tiny implantable devices to help treat chronic pain. Microtransponder, a company out of Dallas, Texas, is developing an implantable neural stimulator to alleviate chronic pain. What a wonderful thing. Looking like an RFID implant, the prototype device uses low-energy radio technology for communication and has no batteries on board. The implanted portion consists of small electrodes and a small coil, which is powered by an external battery-powered coil worn like a cuff on the arm or the leg. The stimulation parameters are programmed via a laptop, a PDA, and would be tailored to the individual patient. Instead of trying to transfer energy from two coupled antennas to do telemetry, which is a common approach for medical devices, RFID is geared to have very small transponders, so you don't need a large coil, says Joseph Prancrazio, a program director of the National Institute of Neurological Disorders and Stroke, a government funding agency in Bethesda, Maryland, that has given the company a small business loan. The research is still in the very early stage. Researchers have developed a prototype device, which they are testing on rats. The device can effectively stimulate peripheral nerves in the rats, though it is not clear whether the electrical stimulation alleviates chronic pain. This is from the company technology page. The Saint TM unit eliminates any implantable battery or wires. It is injectable with a 12-gauge needle in a 30-minute outpatient procedure. This implanted platform technology will be coupled to an external controller, which can be worn like an armband. It will provide the power and stimulus parameters for the device. The external controller will be able to interface with a laptop or PDA in order to change the stimulus parameters to better treat the patient's pain profile. Gosh, I hope that works for people who have chronic pain. That's a terrible way to live, you know, to have, you know, like people have chronic back pain or, you know, maybe pains in their arms or something, or legs. It's wonderful if they can do something from without taking drugs that have so many side effects.
I'm
in.
Yeah,
from the timesonline.com.
Yeah, I'll
do this one.
Okay.
America's richest people meet to discuss ways of tackling a disastrous environmental, social, and industrial threat. Guess what? It's you, folks. You're the threat.
You bet.
Some of America's leading billionaires have met secretly to consider how their wealth could be used to slow the growth of the world's population and speed up improvements in health and education. The philanthropist who attended a summit convened on the initiative of Bill Gates, the Microsoft co-founder, discussed joining forces to overcome political and religious obstacles to change. Described as the good club by one insider, it includes David Rockefeller Jr., yeah, right, the patriarch of America's wealthiest dynasty, Warren Buffett and George Soros, the financiers, Michael Bloomberg, the mayor of New York, and the media moguls Ted Turner and Oprah Winfrey. These members, along with Gates, have given away more than $45 billion since 1996 to causes ranging from health problems, programs in developing countries, to ghetto schools nearer to home. They gathered at the home of Sir Paul Nurse, a British Nobel Prize biochemist and president of the private Rockefeller University in Manhattan, on May 5th. The informal afternoon session was so discreet that some of the billionaire's aides were told they were at a security briefing. Stacey Palmer, editor of the Chronicle of Philanthropy, said the summit was unprecedented. We only learned about it afterwards by accident. Normally, these people are happy to talk about good causes, but this is different, maybe because they don't want to be seen as a global cabal. Some details were emerging this weekend, however. The billionaires were each given 15 minutes to present their favorite cause. Over dinner, they discussed how they might settle on an umbrella cause that could harness their interests. The issues debated included reforming the supervision of overseas aid spending to setting up rural schools and water systems in developing countries. Taking their cue from Gates, they agreed that overpopulation was a priority. This could result in a challenge to some third world politicians who believe contraception and female education weaken traditional values. Gates, 53, who is giving away most of his fortune, argued that healthier families, freed from malaria and extreme poverty, would change their habits and have fewer children within half a generation. At a conference in Long Beach, California last February, he made similar points. Official projections say the world's population will peak at 9.3 billion. But with charitable initiatives such as better reproductive health care, we think we can cap that at 8.3 billion, Gates then said. Patricia Stone Cipher, former chief executive of the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, which gives more than $2 billion a year to good causes, attended the Rockefeller Summit. She said the billionaires met to discuss how to increase giving, and they intend to continue the dialogue over the next few months. Another guest said there was nothing as crude as a vote, but a consensus emerged that they would back a strategy in which population growth would be tackled as a potentially disastrous environmental, social, and industrial threat. Let me go to the second page. This is something so nightmarish that everyone in this group agreed it needs big brain answers, said the guest. They need to be independent of government agencies which are unable to head off the disaster we all see looming. Why all the secrecy? They want us to speak rich to rich without worrying anything that they said would end up in the newspapers, painting them as an alternative world government, he said. Well, it ended up out anyway, so
yeah
for them.
You can't really trust these guys.
Oh, absolutely not.
In fact, Gates and it's a long story on the AIDS and the initiatives and the eugenics and the between Soros and Rockefeller and Gates alone, you're talking the world's you're talking probably in the neighborhood of $150 billion worth of monies. Okay.
That there. More than this?
No, probably well even more. But yeah, we'll see. But anyway, yeah, Sri Lanka accused of ethnic cleansing of the Tamil areas. This was interesting. Something that really hasn't been talked about, even though they defeated the Tamil Tigers.
They're wiping out the people that are left.
Yeah, and killed their leader. Mm-hmm. And now they're going in and they're just destroying the whole group, so they never come back again. And after so many thousand, 25 years or something of fighting. It says, the Sri Lankan government has been accused of launching a campaign of ethnic cleansing following its victory over the Tamil Tigers in the country's 26-year civil war. This is by telegraph.co.uk. And human rights campaigners and politicians claim Tamils have been driven out of areas in the northeast of the country by killing and kidnappings carried out by government militias. They said that the government has simultaneously encouraged members of the Sinhalese majority in the south to relocate to the vacated villages. One foreign charity worker told the Telegraph, the Daily Telegraph, the number of Tamils disappearing in and around Trincomalee, 50 miles south of the final conflict zone in Malliativu, have been increasing in the last 3 months. He claimed to have known 15 of the disappeared, three of whom had been found dead. He said all three bodies showed signs of torture, while two were found with their hands tied behind their backs and single bullet wounds in their heads. Another aid worker said the killings were part of a strategy to drive out the Tamils. Eastern province is vulnerable. There's cleansing by the Sinhalese. There will be more problems with land grabbing and the demography changes, and the Tamils, who are the majority, will soon become a minority, he said. He claimed many villagers had moved out after the army declared their land to be part of a high security zone, and Sinhalese had been given incentives to move in to provide support services to new military bases. And many Tamils sold their homes and land at below prices, market prices, after members of their families had been killed or had disappeared. One Western human rights advocate said Tamils in and around Trincomalee were terrified because they believed the police were either complicit in or indifferent to the number disappearing or found dead. There's no investigation. It's a climate of terror and impunity, he said. And a local campaigner for the families of the disappeared said the killings were speeding the flight of Tamils from the area. When there's a killing, other Tamils move out. Who goes to the Sinhalese police? You either live under threat or you move out, he said. He said that much of the ethnic cleansing was being done in the name of economic development, in which Tamil villagers were being moved out to make way for new roads, power plants, and irrigation schemes, while Sinhalese workers were being drafted in with incentives, including free land and housing. Thousands of Sinhalese are coming in, getting government land and government assistance from the south. It's causing huge tensions, he said. And he and others fear this model will now be applied to the north, where the final army onslaught to defeat the Tamil Tigers left 95% of the buildings demolished or heavily damaged. And since the victory early this month, President Rajapaksa's government has been under pressure to win the peace with a generous devolution package for Tamils in the north. And ministers have said they want to break the identification of the Tamils with the northern and eastern provinces and integrate them into the Sinhalese majority population throughout the country. And in Colombo, billboard posters have contrasted the divide pre-victory Sri Lanka and the Tamil North and East shaded red and the United Post-War Island. Ministers have said billions of dollars will be needed to rebuild the area's roads, building schools, hospitals, communication infrastructure. And community leaders and Tamil politicians fear this will mean a further influx of Sinhalese. Also, an infiltration of the IMF, the in the world,
mm-hmm.
World Bank, and all the other thieves of the global thieves. And R. Samtanthan, the parliamentary leader of the Tamil National Alliance and an MP for Trincomalee, said he shared these fears. A new road being constructed from Subulia, a Sinhalese village, in a district to was under construction, and Sinhalese families were being settled on either side of the road as it snakes further northeast. It's ethnic cleansing, and we're concerned that this is what they will also do in the north, he said. So, the Tamils should have kept on going, kept on fighting. You can understand why they were fighting now, too, because of the ruthlessness of the other,
mm-hmm.
of their
oppressors.
So that's another issue altogether. Before we bring on the interview, there was now as we can talk about. You want to talk about this, or I was kind of excited about that.
Kind of a long one.
Well, this is even longer, but I wanted to talk a little bit about this because it's kind of interesting.
Hmm.
What?
Oh, I was just thinking that they're destroying the farmlands.
Yeah, this article, you can go to URUKNET, URUKNET. This particular article is about Israel destroying Gaza's farmlands. And on the morning of May 4th, Israeli troops set fire to the Palestinian crops along Gaza's eastern border with Israel. The Palestinian Center for Human Rights reported that 200,000 square meters of crop were destroyed, including wheat and barley ready for harvest, as well as vegetables, olives, and pomegranate trees. Local farmers report that the blaze carried over a 4-kilometer stretch on the Palestinian side of the eastern borderland, and efforts to fire brigades to extinguish them. Safadi, who is the spokesman here, says that he was present when Israeli soldiers fired small bombs into his field and soon after caught a blaze. He explained that the Israeli soldiers fired from their jeeps, causing a fire to break out on the land. They burned the wheat, burned the pomegranate trees, and the fire spread across the valley. We called the fire brigades. They came to the area and put out the fire, but in some places the fire started again. He lost 30,000 square meters to the blaze, including 300 pomegranate trees, 150 olive trees, and wheat. These sons of bitches, these freaking Israelis, are just destroying. They're committing genocide against these people. It's a genocide.
Yeah.
And why aren't they calling this out nationally? It's an atrocity. It's an outrage, and it's just horrendous. They can get away with this, and they've been getting away with it for many, many, many years, and it's time they stop. It's time it stops, and it's time this goddamn media begins to understand and shout out against this Israeli insanity, all right, and
when
genocide.
When they do stuff, you have to make sure that you're going to be in the right place at the right time.
What are you talking about?
Well, when they're doing these kinds of things, you got to make sure that these poor people are ready. That they're going to have to...
Ready for what? To stop?
Yeah, and we should be helping them.
Yeah, we should be. I mean, these guys get
they're destroying their food.
Yeah. I mean, Israel is a demonic state.
Well, it's a military theocracy.
Zionist state, and it's just like,
it's not a democratic,
it's a Marxist state. Okay,
it's a Marxist theocracy.
Yeah.
It's a religious government.
And you're a second-class citizen
if you're not.
And these Jews are not even Jews.
No,
they're not even Jews. They're Zionists. They have no belief.
The two Jews would not act like
you know,
that.
They've created the state as their God,
yeah.
And that's what's going on there, and that's how they can morally, how can anybody with a religion morally, you know, destroy and kill and maim and starve and brutalize another people?
How can you defend
how can you do that?
The indefensible.
It's absolutely absurd.
And terrible.
You know, I condemn Israel. I condemn it for what it
and
is.
The people that support it.
And the people that support it. You know,
and that's certain people in this country, and I don't believe
tremendous.
They should
It's unbelievable what they're doing. I mean, it's just out and out genocide. And until it's recorded and until it's reported properly, it's going to continue.
Because I don't think Americans
are stupid freaking people that believe anything that is told to them
on
right
by
TV. As long as you got a Wolf Blitzer up there, you know, who was a former lobbyist for the ADL, right? Telling you what to believe, and editing all the news, so there's never a discouraging word said about Israel. It's absolutely absurd, and it's a frightening issue, and absolutely frightening. So we condemn it. And anyway, we're gonna have that Larry Dorman on shortly. There's an article, and I might extend this out until tomorrow night when I do the show.
It's long.
Very, very interesting. It's about how occult symbols are in corporate logos.
Mm.
And it's a two-part article, and I will get into it. But probably not tomorrow. I just wanted to announce that I think I'll be doing that on the show tomorrow night. For instance, it's just that during the 20th century, urban environments got taken over by corporate logos, and studies have reported that an average person is exposed to about 1,000 logos a day.
Really?
Yeah. Few people.
I don't think about it.
No, you don't. They're
subliminal.
They
yeah.
are subliminal, actually. And the few people, however, ponder on the symbolic meaning of these marketing tools and their occult origins. This article analyzes the esoteric origin of some well-known corporate logos. And think about where you encounter logos on an average day. There are household items on cars, clothes, TV ads, billboards, or insignias all over sporting events and even on this very page. Logos are some of the results of extensive studies funded by Rockefeller and Chicago School. Okay, in cognitive sciences, neuropsychology, and biology. Those studies constitute the core of marketing, a heavily funded field which keeps its findings totally secret from the general public. Why are those findings secret? Well, if you knew why marketing worked on you, you wouldn't fall for it anymore.
Well, this is true.
It says, in the huge visibility of corporate logos, is also an opportunity for the elite to showcase their beliefs and their power. The same way occult symbols are inserted on buildings and sites, you see the sinister sites section, for example. We'll get to that. And they are hidden in plain view on corporate logos. We will now explore the origins and meanings of the symbols used in logos. And the article will focus on the winged sun disk, the Vesica Pisces, and the rising sun. More articles will come dealing with more symbols. And just for an example, and this is a long article, but has 16 pages, and it's only part one. But the winged sun disk.
What is that?
Well, it's a sign of Isis and Horus, but the ancient symbol is commonly associated with Egypt, although it is also used by Persians and Assyrians and also by remote cultures in South America and Australia. It consists of a sun orb flanked by two wings, and the Egyptian traditionally depicted two serpents on the wings, representing the goddesses protecting Upper and Lower Egypt. And
good.
Yeah, and it says,
you're going to go into that more tomorrow because I think that'd be very interesting.
Yeah, and it covers the symbology, the symbolism, as well as the religious. Overtones and connotations
and
magic and
and
how these things play in a tremendous effect on your mind. And part two the occult symbols and corporate logos in Saturn worship. All right, worshiping Saturn, which
I didn't
is
know
basically
that
Satan too. You know, which comes from
Saturn.
The word Saturn, which is the. So you know, we'll get into that tomorrow night with you, and we'll cover that extensively. And all of the corporate logos you're very familiar with and what they really represent. So, and the reasons why they're there, for you know, and what power they give to the marketing or to influencing you. So we're going to do that. But in the meantime, we're going to go to our interview with Larry Dorman.
Yeah, and I think you'll find it informative.
Yeah, we've had Larry on before.
Oh, yeah, he's good.
Many times. And Larry is a spokesman for the, he's the public affairs coordinator for the AFSCME Union, which is the largest, which is an association of federal, state, and county and municipal employees. And they were the largest.
Not federal, state, county. American Federation.
American Federation of the State, County, and Municipal Employees, and their influence on this on Obama's election was extremely great. They were the largest largest donors to the Democratic Party in 2008, and with an estimated $33 million. And I guess it, in many ways, it's helped. It's paid off. We agree. Lila and I agree with the majority of what they're doing, and we believe that they need a strong. This country needs a strong unions, and we hope to. And we appreciate all their work, and we will continue with that. And right now, we have a. That interview with Larry Dorman, the public affairs coordinator for the AFSCME Union.
The things to talk about, and I think he's with us now.
Yeah, how you doing, Larry?
Good, how are you guys? Hi, Lila.
Hi, Larry, we're fine. How are you?
Fantastic, thanks.
Yeah, good. Lots of stuff going on, huh?
Boy, oh boy, no.
There's no rest.
All right, so Larry's excited about
that question.
No, that question too, but he's excited about... Sotomayor.
Oh, you are? Okay. We just...
Let's ask him why.
Yep.
Okay. And Lila's kind of happy with it, too, and I still got a question or two about her.
Leo's not sure about it, but I didn't think she was a bad appointment at all. What are your thoughts on that, Larry?
I think it's a positive move by Obama. I think it's a smart move politically.
Okay.
Given the threat of filibustering and everything else that the very desperate Republicans promised, but as you guys know, she was originally nominated to the federal bench by Bush Senior.
Georgia, yeah.
Yeah, and. In 1997, when Clinton appointed her to serve on the, I believe it was the Second Circuit Court of Appeals, at that point, most of the Senate Republicans opposed her nomination. It took like a year for her to be approved. But, obviously she's filling Souter's spot. And, she's the daughter of a factory worker. She grew up in public housing.
Mm-hmm.
She said in the press, what I saw at the press conference, she talked about firmly believing in the rule of law as the foundation for our basic rights. I think she's already, she's got wide legal experience. She brings much more experience than the younger Bush's nominees did. And above all, my understanding from reading about her on the AFL-CIO website is that she's interpreted labor law, in the manner in which those laws were intended, whether it was workplace discrimination, wage standards, making sure that employees get their health benefits, and she doesn't believe people should be persecuted for union activity. So I think that.
From that standpoint,
I gotta ask. From what you see, is she pro-life?
Is she pro-life? I do not know her position on that.
Because she's a direct one of the board of directors of a maternity I forget the name of the organization, but she's been on with that for quite a while, and what it does is encourages maternity and mothers, childbirth and all that kind of stuff.
Well, in one case, she came down on the side of. under the Bush administration.
Yeah.
The Center for Reproductive Law and Policy versus Bush. Sotomayor upheld the Bush administration's implementation of the Mexico City policy, which requires foreign organizations receiving U.S. funds to neither perform nor actively promote abortion as a method of family planning in other nations. She upheld a policy that the policy did not constitute a violation of equal protection, as the government is free to favor anti-abortion over the pro-choice position and can do so with public funds. That's the one ruling that I have out of eight that I disagreed with her.
But on the other hand,
I liked a lot of her other rulings. So, yeah, well, you're not going to get somebody absolutely perfect. And certainly if she came down strongly on the side of labor, I agree with that.
But you got to wonder, because he's a pro-life, I mean, he's a pro-choice president, you know, campaigned on that all the time. He would appoint a pro-life.
But maybe other things tip the balance for him.
Keep in mind, too, that, you know, again, you can only, I'm sure this will all be covered extensively tonight and tomorrow, but, you know, you can also read between, you can read between the lines. She said, and then some, this is something I took right off the AFL website, "I firmly believe in the rule of law as the foundation for our basic rights, and I will never forget the real-world consequences of my decisions." And, you know, I think it's pretty clear. I don't think Obama is looking for somebody to come in and overturn and, you know, run roughshod around many of the existing laws. I think, you know, we've got to have people in place, you know, and look, this is a contravention of what Bush the Younger, Roberts, and Alito were, well qualified they were, but they were appointed clearly to carry out a political agenda.
Now this thing ticked me off today when I read this, that Barack Obama appointed Louis Sussman to the American ambassador in London, and he was a vice president way up there in Citicorp. All right, and also he was his largest campaign contributor. All right, what he did is, they used to call him, his nickname was called the vacuum cleaner in Chicago. Okay, because he was
great fundraiser.
He was the biggest. He was a huge fundraiser, a campaign cash for Obama's campaign.
Well, yeah, I mean,
and then he gets tagged as the ambassador to London.
Right. Well,
top gravy job, and as far as ambassadors go.
But, you know, right now I'm just trying to focus on what Sotomayor brings, and I think that, again, I think it's a good choice. I think that the fact that she's going to interpret existing law the way they were meant to be interpreted, including.
Well, so far, the only appointment that I think was a really good one was as labor secretary.
Yeah, well, we really like that.
Look, he's going to cut a centrist path on a lot of this stuff. So.
His treasury secretary stinks. I mean, his defense secretary is the same one that Bush had. I mean, my God. All right, what is this guy?
I don't know.
He's starting to really make me worried, I'll tell you, Larry. He's starting to, I really got to wonder with this guy, but we're still hoping.
Yeah, still open. Well, I wanted to talk a little bit about the Employee Free Choice Act.
Yep.
Have we hit a little snag there?
Yeah, you've obviously been following the.
I was very disappointed because I really, really want this bill to pass.
Right, and it seems to have gotten bogged down.
And it seems to have.
Troubling, and it's very disappointing whether it can be salvaged.
Well, you know what, Larry? I think it got, my opinion is, it got bogged down around the great campaign that the opposition rose to the secret ballot and made it seem like it was something nefarious.
Yep.
Like labor was trying to pull a fast one, and it wasn't that at all. But that's the way the public perceived it in those ad campaigns.
Right, and I think that was the perception. And I think that, you know, unfortunately that has, you know, been misplayed or misrepresented.
Oh, terribly.
You know, am I surprised? Yeah. By the same token, probably would, you know, rather have seen this thing, you know, get its sea legs before it was being brought out in the first 3 or 4 months of the new administration.
Well, not only that, Larry.
Hopefully there's time to make some repairs to it. I think that crossing the aisle.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's hope that it's still very much, it is technically still very much alive, but there's been a real campaign of disinformation on the bill and what it does. And, you know, it's unfortunate because it ties directly to the importance and the value of union membership, and there's nothing.
Well, what they did is swiftboat you. They swiftboated.
Yeah,
I mean, they really did. I mean, what happened was is that you didn't.
They made it into something it wasn't at all.
Yeah. Well, they came out and hit the whole concept right in the kneecaps. All right. And then, but you didn't. But it didn't seem like there was a strong enough voice to counteract that. You know. I mean, for all the 10 ads I saw a day on that issue. That was against the issue, against free choice. All right.
Much for
it. There was maybe one, okay, that had anything at all for it. I mean, I didn't see the strong presence there to combat that. And I said, man, they're swiftboating this whole thing. And then Fox, I was watching a few things on Fox, you know, and they were cutting this whole thing, you know, chopping it up and everything else, and saying, how undemocratic a process is this, you know? And,
what they didn't come out and say is that the measure lets workers form a union
right.
if a simple majority signs a card requesting one, in addition to their current option of secret ballot elections. But they didn't phrase it that way.
And they didn't, and the unions didn't say. They didn't say it publicly enough to say, you know, are you harassed, you know, by your employer? Are you this, are you that, are you so on and so forth? This is why we need this ballot. Okay, this is why we need this free choice.
Well, what happened was, as soon as they said you couldn't have a secret ballot, it became about America and freedom and the flag.
Yeah,
and
it's
very hard to fight that.
Because people just didn't understand. If they were non-union, they didn't understand it.
That's right.
If they were trying to form a union, they sure understood what
so
was going on.
So do you think there'll be any changes in that bill, or what do you think is going to happen, Larry?
Very difficult to predict, Lila. I think that clearly there is such well-mounted
campaign
to it that I think it's going to be very hard. But I think something is doable this year. But
oh boy, I hope so.
Well, I think there should be a serious educational campaign.
Well, that's what I was going to get at.
That's what you need.
Probably
throw some union money behind that.
All of us in the labor movement.
Yeah.
To reassess, what the national and local strategies are. If it came down to the Connecticut delegation, there was no problem. They were all very supportive. But Leo used the right analogy. This thing got swift voted. And if the labor movement wants to see this happen, then we're going to have to put a lot more in the way of resources to combat the disinformation and the smears that went out there. Because, you know, the tragedy is that we need more unions, not fewer.
Right.
And there should be public debates on this. I mean, there should be open public debates on this issue, pro-con. And, where people can actually understand what this
right.
is.
Right. And you hope, too, that Congress, the leadership in Congress, really is deep down supportive of this as well.
Yeah.
We had a talk the other day with a friend of ours. We were actually on Memorial Day. We were sitting around, you know, enjoying Memorial Day and cooking on the grill like we all do. And,
I already told him.
Oh, you did. Yeah, our friend is he works hard and he supports unions. And he said he often hears from people, you know, what good do unions do? They only make our costs go up. And he said, you know, I wish I had like 5 or 6 things that I could just really come back with them at them and say, this is why unions are good. I had a few things, but we thought we'd ask you that question, Larry. What are the really good things about unions that makes them so worthwhile to this country and to the American to America as a whole? My sense is that it made the middle class be so viable and have a
This is a night of difficult troubles, I tell you. We're not streaming. Lost our stream. And now for some reason my tape has been eaten up again. We're just having a hell of a hard time here tonight. As my good friend would have said, my guy, former, he passed away last year, Bill Marshall, used to say, Mercury is in retrograde. Whenever there was a problem with communications, it seems like something is in retrograde. And I don't know what the hell happened here. We're going to be able to, finally, we've got the resources to put our shows on, record our Tuesday night programs on I don't have to bother with these damn, this ancient technology here of tapes, but our studio, our FM studio, unfortunately, didn't have that ability for some reason, and finally we do, so these things will now be on a different format starting next week, but unfortunately not this week. So man, I can't believe what a mess this one was. Tape stick in your tape recorder. But anyway, we're tomorrow night's show. I'm going to delve into these into this article. It's quite lengthy. It's about it's two parts, and but it's a very, very good explanation of the of how we are being manipulated. You know, we all know that we're being manipulated in the marketplace. We're being manipulated by the advertising companies. We're being manipulated by our government. We're being manipulated by everybody with a few bucks who wants to sell us something. But you know what, why it's interesting to note why all of these corporations and non-government, you know, organizations and all organizations seem to want to go with these occult logos. And some of them are Masonic, and some of them are, many of them are satanic and paganistic, and, it's just a remarkable manipulation of the the mind, how we are continually being manipulated by the media in so many ways. But thankfully there are people out there that are catching this, understanding this, and writing about it and trying to educate educate us as to what's really happening out there. And it's really quite frightening, I have to say. Over the last, I'd say probably the last 10 years, I've been following these many, this issue on subliminal marketing, subliminal, and delving somewhat into the conspiracy aspect of these things. And it's frightening how we have been so manipulated, and how we are continually being manipulated, not only by textbooks and the educational system, and the media is per se as to what they're trying to present to the world. It's like in who and what are responsible for everything that's going wrong. It's quite valid. Many of the theories are quite valid and been proven by many, many, many intelligent and well-researched people. And they've come up with a summary to a summation of these aspects of our daily lives that are being manipulated, being presented, and being we're being, it's as though they're talking a different language than they're a secret language to each other, not to us, saying things. ours, who I hope to have on again soon on our program, wrote a remarkable book, and it was called Codex Magico, and it shows all of the different Masonic as well as satanic logos, symbolisms, archaeology, architecture, and what's really happening around the world, and who these leaders are, and what their motivations are, what their motives are, and who they're really following. It shows how so many of us are being manipulated by satanic groups that are, through their black magic, if you will, and some forms of sorcery, are actually manipulating us into the into obeying their every wish. Buy Nike, buy Coca-Cola, buy Shell Oil, buy Exxon Mobil, whatever it is that we buy, and we're being told constantly to do that, and it's not a good thing, not a good thing at all. But the only way that we can combat that is by knowing about it, and that's my intention. Has been my intention all along, to try to, as soon as I found out about it, to try to tell people about it and make them aware of what's going on. I don't know if I can recover this tape. It looks pretty bad in some parts, but at least it's not broken. But anyway, I wanted to see if maybe I can fast forward this thing and bring it ahead. Play the rest of that interview with Larry. See if I can do that. Hang on. Get to a place where it's not corrupted. Let's see if we can replay this. We can play this interview. Continue it. Without it being destroyed again. And let's try to continue this.
Responsible in large part for the creation of a vital middle class. Sometimes I like to step back and say, and ask people, contemplate actually sort of a, look at it by the negative image of a film, and look at it this way. When unions were at their peak in terms of density, in terms of being, in terms of their proportion of the workplace, which I'm talking like the mid-60s, roughly one out of three American workers had a union card. That was actually the high point of the earning power of middle-class workers. As unions have declined in number and as a percentage of the working population, average wages have actually fallen just as dramatically. So that kind of tells you everything you need to know. So before I extol the virtues of belonging to a union, I'll just remind everyone that the decline of the middle class is very much, correlates to the decline in union numbers. And when unions were stronger, and they were, and I'll be the first to admit that they have declined in numbers, when unions were stronger, the benefits of economic prosperity were more broadly shared. So it wasn't simply union members themselves who were benefiting, but the larger economy benefited. More workers had health care coverage. More workers were earning better than the minimum wage. We essentially built the foundation and raised the floor.
I can list probably at least 10 right off the top of my head. Okay, that if it weren't for unions, there wouldn't be a minimum wage. There wouldn't be health insurance for employees. There wouldn't be OSHA, all right? There wouldn't be workman's compensation. There wouldn't be, I had them all. No, there's so many. There wouldn't be bargaining and negotiations. There
wouldn't
be.
You wouldn't have
all kinds
of things.
Yeah, you know, you wouldn't. There's just. He goes. The list is endless. I mean, and I think that the unions are extremely viable and helpful. But there's so much misinformation, and ever since the Reagan administration, the unions again were kneecapped. You know.
Yep.
And with that firing the air traffic controllers, all right, and everything else, and it was downhill ever since. Downhill ever since. My father, I just interject. My father hated Reagan.
Right.
Because he was a government worker. He was a customs, actually an immigration worker, director, and he hated Reagan with a passion at what he was doing to what he did to the government employees. He hated Bush even more. You know, and he resigned. Actually, he retired. He took early retirement just because it was such a horrible situation working for the government under that Republican administration, under those Republican administrations.
Well, let me get, if you go back over time, really brief historical thumbnail here. What have unions accomplished for all workers? Again, before I talk about, you talk about the specifics. I firmly believe, guys, unions have made life better for every working American. We helped pass laws that ended child labor. We fought for the establishment of the 8-hour day.
Yeah.
Mentioned OSHA. Well, unions have been at the forefront of protecting worker health and safety. We helped create Social Security, unemployment insurance, and the
right. Right. No, everything of a
humane.
I was gonna say everything.
It would still
of
be hooked to the plow, and the plow would still be moving.
Exactly.
We'd be dragged along.
Exactly.
Now, interestingly, the economics will back me up, in terms of clearly, if you have a union car, you're going to have much better wages and benefits.
Right.
The average union, the average median weekly earning for a union worker is about $863, and the average median weekly earnings for a non-union worker is about $663. So that's a 30% difference. That's pretty sizable.
Mm-hmm.
More unionized workers have decent health care and a pension plan. So, those are things.
But we've mentioned this before, but the one thing that infuriates me, and always has infuriated me, is that the success of the non-union workers has always been because of the union workers, okay? Whenever they have these open shops where they, join the union or not join the union, but they all wind up getting the same pay, even though, they get benefits, they get rights and benefits that the unions have fought for. And yet, and industry-wide, and then you still have these places that are non-union that are benefiting from all of the things the unions have done, all right, and are still doing. And, it's just, I don't know, it infuriates me when you...
It infuriates me too, trust me,
I mean, when people realize, think, you can do without the union, try to do without the union. They'll throw you out the door, the minute you look cross-eyed at somebody.
Try negotiating on your own for a better wage.
Right.
In today's economy.
it's just a joke.
That's the thing, is that, above and beyond the economics, again, the economics will bear me out.
Right.
Union workers have higher wages and better benefits, but I think that when you talk to workers, like we organized part-time paraprofessionals, 130 of them in the town of Glastonbury earlier this year, and what excited them most when they voted overwhelmingly to organize and to join us, Council 4, and while I was a school employee, you can appreciate this, what they have suffered most with is disrespect from the superintendent on down. They provide direct services, special ed services, et cetera, to the kids, and yet they're the last people who factor into any decision making. So, yes, they understand they have a chance of earning better and more equal wages, but what was big for them was respect. And that's what I find, all over the state when I talk to our members who are in unions, or when you talk to workers who are trying to organize a union, it's that form a union at the workplace, is that they're going to have a voice at work. They're going to be able to, in a polite and constructive way, challenge the boss. And if they think they're being treated unfairly, they're going to be able to challenge that, too, through the grievance process. And that's, I think, important, because you can't have unchecked, there needs to be a counterbalance to the ultimately provides is that you have a voice at work to improve the product or the service you provide, and you have the ability, to question whether or not people are being treated fairly and whether laws are being obeyed. I think that's priceless.
I do too. I agree with you.
And you have a skilled voice for you, someone who understands the process, who's been through it, and someone to call on to help you with that process.
We negotiate so many of our contracts in the state and municipal sector. We negotiate job training and education opportunities so members can learn. We provide cross training. We all kinds of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
We do. We have unions at the municipal level doing health and safety remediation. We have our correction officers who fought for funding to get two-way radios to make the prison safer. Those are all things that you wouldn't be able to do necessarily without an advocate at the workplace, and the advocate is the workers themselves through their union, and that's what's important.
So what do you think is going to happen now under the cuts that REL has made? All right, how many jobs will essentially be affected by that?
The target moves in that there's going to be, hopefully there will be a budget at some point this year. Her original budget, which right now is the only proposal that, she's put
out there, yeah.
Potentially there are economists who say that it would bleed Connecticut up to, 30,000 jobs.
Wow.
There's massive service and programmatic cuts in aid to cities and towns, like our schools. What's more troubling now is that as the deficit is mounted, we've come to find out that Connecticut is almost dead last in terms of reclaiming or seeking or petitioning for stimulus money from the Obama administration.
Really?
Essentially left upwards of $500 million on the table.
Why is that?
I wish you could ask her.
Has anyone said, why are we not getting this?
Is she going to be,
I'm not being flip when I give you the answer, Lila. She has been asked by the congressional delegation, specifically Congressman Joe Courtney. She has been urged, and I would be happy to email you the letter. She's being urged to put forward a request for stimulus money that would go to cities and towns, specifically,
right.
I think, education and other vital services. So there's stimulus money available that she's not even claiming. Now, is it laziness? Is it the laziness of her administration? Is it a cynical calculation that she, her administration wants to see things get worse? I don't know, and I don't want to speculate.
Well, I think she's like, Palin and that lunatic from Louisiana, their governor out there, who don't want to take the stimulus, and they don't want to take it all, or they don't feel like it's this Republican right to be ridiculous,
right?
Right.
To make things worse,
yeah.
Better.
She has a July 1st deadline.
Right. So Congressman Courtney and others are pushing and asking, why aren't you going to bat for Connecticut?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I hope it's not that she's decided to behave like, the governor of South Carolina.
Yeah, yeah, like these idiots, or like the guy in Louisiana or Palin, but it's just, REL has done something ridiculous.
Yeah.
Anyway, I've never understood her policies, since she's taken. I didn't even know why Connecticut even bothered voting her in after Roland. Have no idea. But,
popularity has been generally very high, and I think it's because she really hasn't done anything.
Yeah,
she hasn't made any mistakes, so she doesn't do anything.
Correct.
But she's
out there ready to kiss everybody, though.
I guess the press likes
she
that.
She kisses the troops when they come home, and she kisses the cancer patients, and she kisses everybody that needs to be kissed, but she doesn't do anything other than kiss. God.
I was wondering if we do get that money, how they're going to track the towns on how they use this money. I know one of the things that towns like to do, and I guess all states and towns and governments do this, they kind of juggle the books and a little bit here and from there, and everything is all. I wonder if there's a tracking process on how the money is used.
I'm sure there is, and it varies as to there is accountability, but then again, there's also there are also loopholes. You know, we want to see from the union's perspective, from perhaps me and other unions, we want to see accountability and transparency.
Yeah, I want to see that the jobs of teachers and aides and
right.
people in the schools are safe.
Well, that's exactly right. I mean, are we actually legitimately creating real jobs and providing services, or are we just, is the money going to, you know, private interest groups and, you know, contractors?
Yeah,
right.
You worry about that sort of stuff. But, of course, she has to get the application in
right.
by July 1st.
Yeah, but, I mean, there are mayors, for instance, who are getting hold of stimulus money. But I think the accountability question that you're both raising is a good one, Dan. I think it would be disingenuous of me to say there's a firm process in place. Clearly, you know, we want to see one, and we want to make sure that this is public money.
Yeah.
This is taxpayer dollars, and there ought to be accountability, and, you know, there ought to be jobs created in the public and nonprofit sector to fill these needs.
Absolutely.
Otherwise, if it's just going to contractors and politically connected employers, then that's not a good use of the money.
No.
Hey, I wanted to ask you about, before we finish tonight, I wanted to ask you about the Obama's rejection of the single-payer tax, single-payer health care. You know, I read it the other, was it last week or so, that he came out and said it's not going to happen. Single-payer is not going to happen.
I think clearly that they they're hewing to a pragmatist line.
Yeah.
His health care plan obviously is not a single-payer plan. Personally, I would like to see a single-payer plan.
Mm, me too.
I would like to see every American have access to quality health insurance. I just think it's the biggest problem gripping working people and gripping the economy. I'm not convinced that people in the Obama administration are supportive conceptually of single payer. I don't think there is a political will right now to take on a fight that they see as a losing fight. And you can say that's good, you can say that's pragmatic, or you can say that it's a retreat from you know, what he promised, but, you know, he has introduced a comprehensive bill. It provides a great deal of money for local health care plans. It, you know, has the electronic data component that's badly needed. So there are pieces to the plan that work. And, but, you know, again, I'm not going to sit here and say it's, you know, does it possibly set the stage for single payer? Perhaps. But until we really tackle, you know, these underlying issues, I think we're nibbling at the edges. And again, I've said this before on your show, I'll say it again. Canadian automakers versus American automakers. The pension and health liability is about $1,500 a car, according to the Canadian Labor Congress. And in Canada, because of their what amounts to a single-payer system, it's $250.
Wow.
Every employer in Canada is on a level playing field, whether they're in the automotive business industry or something.
Right.
And that really explains it all, Larry.
Yeah,
I mean,
you've got to have a system, and I'm with you guys on this, but clearly, like it or not, I think the Obama administration is taking...
And I think the health insurance people have a way, way too much clout in this Congress and administration.
Well, we have to be concerned about the Republicans' health care reform legislation. I mean, that's really lousy. They
that's
want to...
why, you know, and maybe we can talk about this next month. We, at least at the state level, we're pushing for really good solutions like the pooling bill and like Justinet.
I think the
philosophy of labor and community and healthcare advocates in Connecticut is let's not wait around for, you know, the Obama administration. Let's get something done.
Absolutely.
And one of the things we can get done is open up the state plan to municipalities and nonprofits. And one thing we can do is to advocate for the Sustenet healthcare bill. So we are fighting, at least in Connecticut.
That's past the health.
The pooling bill. On the pooling bill evades me. Sustenet is 6600, House Bill 6600, but you know, both are on our Council 4 website, council4.org, right on the homepage. And these are good, sensible initiatives that
mm-hmm.
will hopefully bring health care to more people in Connecticut. They're not single payer, but clearly the you know, having a plan like the state employee plan that's essentially a nonprofit mutual fund, make it available to everyone, brings us a little bit closer to the health care for everyone idea.
Well, we can talk a little bit more next month about that, and we look forward to doing it. It's always great to hear from you, Larry.
Yeah, this was fun. I really appreciate good timing. I appreciate you guys having me.
Yeah.
Oh, well, we always enjoy having you. Keep on working for us.
Good, and we'll talk soon.
Okay. Good night, Larry.
Bye-bye.
This is Larry Dorman, Public Affairs Coordinator for the AFSCME Union, which is the union for state, county, and municipal employees.
Yes.
Okay, Leo, it's that time.
Yes.
Okay. And that was the that was our interview with Larry Dorman. I'm hoping this show is being recorded, and I want to thank John S. there for helping us out. Hope everything works out and this show gets to be aired. I'm going to wish everybody a good night. I hope that please join us tomorrow on Thursday when we discuss the corporate logos. Okay, called symbols and corporate logos. We'll be spending the entire show on that. I have two major articles on it to read and discuss. So I hope you have a good night. And again, John, thank you. And all right, and we will end tonight. And good night.